So in 1957, a guy came up with an idea for a toy that still exists among us. And I figure the guy had to be a grandpa giving this toy to his grandchild. You know what toy I'm talking about? It's the corn popper toy. The little push in front toy. Yeah, when is a gift not a gift? When grandpa gives grandchild a corn popper toy, that's when it's not a gift. You know why? Because every parent is like, I had enough trouble getting the youngest to sleep without the older kid trying to learn to walk with the stupid corn popper popping throughout the house and waking up everybody else in the house. And this is the way of grandparenting, I think. I remember as a young dad, my in-laws particularly were guilty of this. They would buy us lots of toys for the kids, buy the kids lots of toys, and you'd get them all, right? And they all have 100 of the little twisty ties on them. And so you would spend hours on Christmas morning or on their birthday unwrapping, unlocking these toys. And I don't know if you know children very well or not, but they're not patient for you getting the toy out of the wrapper. And so sometimes, you know, we get people gifts, and those gifts are obnoxious to the other people that receive those gifts. The government does this to you. They tell you that a 16-year-old is mature enough to drive a vehicle. And you, parents, most of us, we buy into that. We're like, yes, they probably need a license. So they should have a one-ton or more vehicle battering ram to drive around irresponsibly. Young people, I'm just telling you, none of us were good drivers. We thought we were, but we weren't. What is a gift? Not much of a gift. And sometimes it happens the same way with God, where what he provides to us in his wisdom doesn't seem very generous. I'm going to argue today that these few passages in James chapter 1, you can start turning there, James chapter 1, turn there, click there, however you access the word. We're in the English Standard Version. That's normalized across the platform here, so we'll always use the ESV. We're in James chapter 1. We're picking up from what we talked about last time, really all the way through verse 8 last time. And he presented to us what I think is the controlling principle in all of James. Number one, that we are out of sync with our world. To live as a believer, a follower in Jesus, means you're going to feel and be out of sync with the world. You have to get used to that. And it's going to mean that your pursuits and the pursuits of your neighbors aren't the same pursuits. And he told us that steadfastness is what creates maturity. And so we have to learn how to endure. And when we endure, we have to count joy the situations in life, the trials we come across, because those things create what God desires for them to create in us. Your trials are from God, and they are for the purposes of God. And so he tells us in verse 2 to count them joy, to count your many different trials. You say, well, should I count it joy when I've caused myself problems from long-term sins and habits and brokenness and all that? Even that, yes, you should count as joy. Even if you are the dummy, you should still count as joy the trials that you endure, even so, because of the goodness of who God is. And so in our present passage, we're going to talk from verse 9 down through verse 18. I think I made a mistake last week. I'll tell you what my mistake is. I think my mistake was in waiting for 9 through 11. You see that in your Bibles, to talk about with this week rather than with last week. It's a bridging passage, and it's way out of sync with anything around it. James doesn't care whether you get whiplash in reading his text. He cares that you understand where he's going and what he's talking about. And it seems to me, in the generosity of God's wisdom, that we always get when we look to God for what he's doing in our trials and in the tough situations, we're always going to get more than we asked for. But those gifts sometimes come to us as rather obnoxious things. Things we didn't exactly ask for. We were like, Lord, I need you to fix this problem, and I need to know what decision to make right now. Yes or no, go this way, go that way. And God says, well, let me tell you about both ways. Let me tell you about the context you're talking about. Let me tell you about where it ultimately they end up. And we're like, Lord, no, I don't want that. I want red light, green light. That's what I want. I don't want any yellow lights in my life. I don't want any cautions. I want to know, do I do this or not? Interestingly, that's never how you train children. You know life is nuanced. There are very few decisions that are yes or no. And don't believe me? Dinner time comes around. That should always be a yes answer from your kid. Do you want to eat? Yes, all the time. Yes. Do you not want to eat? No, I always want to eat. I'm 3, I'm 4, I'm 15, I always want to eat. But it's not that easy, is it, parents? Because your kids have their own attitude and their own sin nature, and sometimes they want to play you for better food, food that they want. Why do we have to eat this? I like toaster strudels and Pop-Tarts, and I ought to get to eat them all the time. No, but you have to eat some real food sometimes. And your kid then goes defiant. Do you want to eat? Do you want to survive? Yes, I want to eat. I want to survive. But I don't want to eat what you give me, mom or dad. It's not easy, right? Why can't it be easy? And so you know why it's not easy on God. Because we want red lights and green lights, goes and stops. But we don't want caution, and we don't want the bigger picture. And what God always provides in our request for wisdom, that he's going to push forward in this context in our next passages here, he's still talking about accessing the wisdom of God. And today what I want us to walk away with, I want us to know how to gain the gift of God, how to gain that wisdom, because it is the good gift of God. So notice what he says in verse 9. He says, let the lowly brother boast in his exaltation and the rich in his humiliation, because like a flower of the grass or like a wild flower in the grass, he will pass away. For the sun rises with its scorching heat and withers the grass. Its flower falls and its beauty perishes. So also will the rich man fade away in the midst of his pursuits. And then he goes to verse 12, blessed is the man. You catch that? All right, now, if you are reading closely and you read out of, like, say, verse 7, for that person must not suppose that he will receive anything from the Lord, meaning any wisdom from the Lord. He is a double-minded man, unstable in all his ways. And then he seems to talk about rich and poor, or rather rich and lowly. And then he goes back to the man who remains steadfast under trial. It's almost as if he decided later to come back and insert verses 9 through 11 just because he wanted to toss something in randomly in the book. And if you read James's letter, it feels really random there. I think the reason he does this is because there's two kinds of pursuits in the world. There's the kind of pursuit that involves money, gain, things you have, things you own. There's that pursuit. And then there's the pursuit of the things that God would provide to you. The kind of gains that are hard to calculate and are hard to quantify in your life. And so he lays out in front of us that if you are lowly, you should boast in your exaltation because that's where God takes you. And if you're rich, meaning you're proud in this life, you should boast that you will be humiliated. Like, guys, on the global scale, we're all rich. as far as that's concerned. But this is not about physical possessions. This is about spiritual pursuits. This is about what we actually want to gain out of life. And if you want the gift of God, then you have to desire to gain something that the rest of the world is not pursuing. You see, I think the world loves a good gold rush. And there's always some kind of gold rush going on. It drug people from the East Coast to the West Coast in our nation's history. It has drug people around the world to find El Dorado in the New World. Like, people have always loved a gold rush. We've always had some kind of gold rush. And even now, you young people, you're thinking about, what am I going to do in my life? And what schooling am I going to get? And is it going to have some gold attached to it? Hey, you know what? At one level, you need to think that way, right, adults? Like, you need to think about, does this pay for anything? So while you may want to be an artist, the other question is, most of us are not like Michelangelo, and even he wasn't rich in his life, and he carved the Naked David statue. Right, so you can be an artist, but your parents are going to be like, okay, but how are you going to pay the bills? There is some gold involved, and I don't think James is talking about gold per se. He's talking about pursuits. And so he lays out then in verse 12, the pursuit. He says, blessed is the man who remains steadfast under trial, for when he has stood the test, he will receive the crown of life, which God has promised to those who love him. So you have two people in this. You have the steadfast person, and you have the rich person. The rich man fades away in the midst, even while he's pursuing, and the blessed man, the steadfast man, gains throughout life. You have one who's going down and the other who's going up. The steadfast person is the one who's going up. So here's what you have to decide. The disciple has to decide that he wants the crown of life. That's what you have to decide. If you are a disciple here today, meaning you have trusted in the Lord Jesus for your salvation, you've confessed him as Lord, and you believed on the sacrifice that he gave for you, if you are that person, a disciple of Jesus, you have to decide that you want the crown of life. Many of our problems in this life are because we're double-minded. We say to God, I want you, I want what you give, I want you, what you provide. But then we say to our employer, I want you, I want what you give, I want what you provide. And we're double-minded in our faith. You realize that you have to be single-minded in where the generous things come from. And if they come from any other source, then you will be distracted in your life. So you have to decide what kind of reward you want. And you have to decide as a disciple that you want the crown of life. That's what he just tells us. He says, listen, if you're lowly, it's good because you'll be exalted. Presumably then the lowly brother is the one who is the blessed man who's remained steadfast under trial. Because after the trial, did you catch that? For when, verse 12, for when he has stood the test, he will receive the crown of life. And God has promised it to those who love him, to disciples. You realize that because of the way you were recreated through faith in Christ, you are headed toward the crown of life. You can create complications on your road by having multiple pursuits. You know, we come to different bridges in our lives, and our young people know this more than maybe the rest of us because they look at their graduation and it's the big bridge. It's the bridge between where grade and age compelled you forward, and then you cross graduation, you cross that bridge into young adulthood, and people, like, it's no longer what grade you're in, it's no longer what age you are. You start having all the choices on your own. And it's a difficult time for our young people. We lose many of them to the world during that time because it's so difficult to walk across that bridge. But you know what? There's other bridges. If, many of you You've got babies on the way. I think we've got at least seven, maybe six because one was just born, but maybe seven in the congregation that have children in utero right now. And you know what, guys? Even though you're not carrying the baby, you have to decide, I'm going to be the father to this baby. Now, it is natural, right? The baby will be born. Moms, you have to decide, I'm going to be a mom to this baby. Just because you carry the child doesn't mean that you follow through with the duties and responsibilities incumbent on you. You have to decide to walk across that bridge. Some of you guys, you've gone through retirement and you lost all purpose in life. And you wonder and you want to go back to work. You know what? To cross that bridge is a big step. These are existential crises where we're not quite sure who we are anymore. You guys in midlife, I want to tell you, you have to decide, I'm not a young man, I'm a middle-aged man. And if you make that decision, it will help you. If you say, this is my career, this is what I do, this is who I am, and this is where I'm going, and I could be more faithful to Christ, but maybe I can't change my career. Listen, guys, you get somewhere along the way. If you live with regrets about all the things you weren't, you will never hear from God about all the things He's creating you to be. You get to these bridges and you have to decide. And you have to decide here that I will be and will gain the crown of life. God's promised it to me. So verse 13. And He says, here's another distraction. So riches were a distraction, and here's another one. Let no one say when he is tempted, I am being tempted by God. For God cannot be tempted with evil, and He Himself tempts no one. But each person is tempted when he is lured and enticed by his own desire. Then desire, when it is conceived, gives birth to sin, and sin, when it is fully grown, brings forth death. You decide you want the crown of life, and then you realize that you got problems. You got things that don't get crowned. And all of us have things in our life, sin in our life, that doesn't get crowned. You realize that what God is doing in your trials, not in your temptation, but in your trials, He is purifying you of sin. And sin, notice, He gives us this sense of progression, but you notice that also this temptation begins within you, not outside of you. Here's the point. God didn't make your troubles, but He is forming your head to the crown. He's forming your crown. Your head doesn't fit the crown He has for you yet because of sin, but He is forming you so that inevitably you will wear that crown. This means that the brokenness you have now, you have to decide is foreign to you, not a part of you. Like my, you know, the way I feel about my sin, I feel like it's always been here and it always will be. Well, that is a defeatist, broken view of what God does, because God transforms. However, it requires a lot of pressure sometimes. There's a process called hydroforming. I think we've got a little example for you here. There's a process of hydroforming in which water pressure shapes steel welded structures into spheres. That's pretty fantastic, isn't it? That's real. That's not AI, that's real. This is a common process. And for that kind of shaping, it requires 10 to 15,000 psi of water pressure within at an explosive force in order to generate the full sphere. Some containers, depending on what they are, require up to 100,000 psi. That's a lot of pressure, folks. And I want you to know, sometimes some of us, even right now, feel a ton of pressure from our sin, from the temptation within you. And temptation will deform you. Trial will form you. God's creating you into a useful vessel. And that requires pressure. In the case of hydroforming, it's internal pressure. And so he says, listen, you shouldn't look at God and say, well, God is forming me through my temptations. Because that's a tendency. And actually, the word tempted here and trial elsewhere have a very familiar Greek root. They're very close to the same word, and they sound kind of the same. Trial and temptation for us, and in the Greek, temptation and trial are very similar. We think about it this way. Trial is usually the things that are external to us, and temptations are the things that are internal to us. Here's what I found. There's usually a combination, an impact between the expectations of God, the external, and the brokenness within, the internal. And he lays it out for us. He says, here's where temptation comes from. It starts with you. It doesn't start with God. Each person is tempted when he is lured and enticed, look, by his own desire. Did you catch that? Why can't I break free? Because I think there is soul corruption, that's a meaning internal, our basic selves that are also broken, not just our behaviors, but at the core of who we are, there's brokenness there, and our souls are dissatisfied. And those dissatisfied souls create internal desires, and notice then what happens in the deformation process. Desire is conceived in us, so that moment you say, I really want that. You don't have to vocalize it, it just has to crop up in your head. There are triggers for this kind of thing, is what they're called. Sometimes it's random and brand new. You say, you know, I wonder if I could be happier in a different marriage. You realize what that is? It's a dissatisfied soul. And it's now found its way to verbalization. It doesn't start as verbalization, but it works its way up into verbalization. It starts as an internal desire, and then it grows. It conceives. And what does it conceive? I think that internal desire of, like, I'm a little discontent with my relationship. It conceives and gives birth to the statement, well, maybe I could be happier with somebody else. And sin, when it is fully grown, fully deforms your life. So it's foolish to blame God for the temptation you experience. It's also foolish to think that God has nothing to do or nothing that he does to redeem you from the brokenness you have. You realize that at this point in time, you could just pause time right now, and God would have an on-road to a pursuit of the crown of life for you in the next moment. God's power to create life from death is such that he can take wherever your kids are and you wish they weren't, and he could turn them around in the next moment. He can take your life wherever it is right now, and however consumed you feel like it is, and however broken you're concerned about, and it could transform in the next moment. But listen, you transform in this not by being perfect in the next moment, but by deciding in this one that the next part of life is going to be different. You have to decide that. And God is already ahead of you, and he's already forming your crown for those who know him. And yet there's always this pressure and always this trial. And you say, well, what if I decide today and I fall tomorrow? Okay, well, what if you fall tomorrow? Is God not able in that moment as well to rescue, to redeem, to get you back on the path? You see, I think we think that God is limited in his redemption, but God is unlimited in his redemption, and he calls you even now, and he says the first step to cross the bridge is to decide that you're going to cross. You see, God's gift, so notice what he does. He tells us what sin produces. And if you desire, like the rich brother, to be exalted in your riches, you should boast, verse 9, in your humiliation. But all of that will pass away. God doesn't take our gold as payment, and he doesn't exalt us in it. In fact, if you are rich and you're a disciple, God will use your money in this world because he can't use it in the next. And so verse 16, he says, don't be deceived, my beloved brothers. Every good gift and every perfect gift, there's a single gift described in two ways, a good gift and a perfect gift, is from above. If you get a good thing, it's from God. That's what he's saying. A perfect gift, a good gift. You didn't dream it up. You didn't think it up. It's from above. You know what I find? I find that the really good gifts that I get for Tracy were inspired elsewhere. I'm just not great at thinking of other kinds of gifts. You have to explore. You have to get out there and look around. And you have to try to find a good gift that's going to be a blessing and not a curse. And over time, being married, you figure out what are bad gifts. Like, you know, you don't buy your wife a vacuum cleaner for Christmas. That's not a good gift. I mean, your household might need it, but you find some other time to gift it, not at Christmas time. Don't do that. Don't buy her a lawnmower. I've done that. She said she wanted one, but apparently you don't do that. All the good gifts, all the perfect gifts, all the generous components of how God transforms a life. Don't be deceived, brethren. Those good things, those perfect things are from above, coming down from the Father of lights, with whom there is no variation or shadow due to change. You know what he's talking about? Your shadow changes every moment of the day as the sun, as the earth turns across the rays of the sun. And so your shadow is ever changing. But with God, there's both no shadow and there's no variation. There's no darkness at all in which to hide. So when God gives a gift, you should expect it to be global in your life, meaning it doesn't leave room for shadow. Now that's hard. I think that's hard for us to understand, because usually we say, Lord, get me out of this problem. And what we mean is just the little portion of the problem. But you realize God never is just fixing your behaviors. He's also fixing your soul. So when he looks at you and he sees you and he works in you, he's not just getting you past alcohol or getting you past adultery or getting you past broken sinfulness. He's transforming the wholeness of who you are. And so it doesn't always make sense to us. But God does take you serious. So some of us, we know that our kids have problems. And those problems are shadowed by our limits on wisdom. We just can't see the fullness and the depth of what's going on. I ask parents sometimes to clarify. They'll tell me something that's going on they're concerned about and say, okay, well, let me ask you this. Do you think their behaviors are foolishness or wickedness? Like, you know the difference in your kids. If your kids look at you defiantly and say no, that's wickedness. If they make mistakes and they break a plate, it's foolishness. And if they try and they fail, versus if they actively, aggressively defy, you know, sometimes they make mistakes in their relationships. We make mistakes in our relationships. And the question is, are we just foolish and inexperienced, or are we being wicked? Absolutely. You see, God knows how to see all of it and know that part that's inexperience and that part which is active defiance. And when we ask God for the crown of life that he's promised us, he begins to form us, not just in the open parts that we're aware of, but in the shadowy parts that we're not aware of. And that's why his gift is so whole and complete. And you know what? Look, when you attack evil in your life, it's going to hurt you. Okay, I'm going to be a geek, all right? I'm just setting you up for this. I was reading Return of the King by Tolkien, The Lord of the Rings. I need a little love. Is it okay? Okay. And I was also studying James. It was a few months ago as we were running up to this. And Tolkien writes the following words on the lips of Aragorn, who is the healer king. And this is after Merry the Hobbit. Sorry, this is getting really geeky. The more I talk about it, it's getting geekier. Merry the Hobbit was injured killing the Witch King. And just the act of stabbing him had harmed him and nearly killed him. Aragorn says, "Do not be afraid. I came in time, and I have called him back. He is weary now and grieved, and he has taken a hurt, daring to smite that deadly thing. But these evils can be amended. So strong and happy a spirit is in him, in Merry. His grief he will not forget, but it will not darken his heart. It will teach him wisdom." Now, in a way that only Tolkien can do, he encases this operation of God. These words are incredibly wise, actually, because there's two ways your trials and difficulties can go. They can darken your heart and make you hate the kinds of things that God does, or they can embolden your spirit and teach you wisdom. When you decide you want the crown of life, then what they do, what the hurts and the harms from killing sin does, they create wisdom in you. See, I think Tolkien understood something on the spiritual side that he writes then into his narrative. He understands that even to attack evil is to be harmed by it. And folks, I want to tell you, you get serious about sin and brokenness and frustration and anger in your life, and you will incur damage from the effort. You decide to be liberated from compulsive sin, addiction, bad habit, and all of that, and it causes problems for you. It doesn't just solve them and everything gets bright and happy. It creates problems. You have to repattern your life. You have to throw things out that are valuable to you. You have to change your route home from work because you find triggers along the way. Like when you decide to pursue the crown of life, you have decided a life path, and every new life path comes with all kinds of painful transformation. I think the health and wealth prosperity doctrine has become so ingrained across our minds that we think somehow that to walk with God is to find prosperity in this life. And James says, let me tell you what you ought to hope for. You rich, you health and wealth people, you ought to boast in the humiliation you're going to experience, because that's the pathway of God. To make us small in our own estimation and great in God's estimation, that's the question. Do you want his crown, or do you really just want to make your own? So, we need some principles, I think, for being formed by the gifts of God. Kind of understand the purview that they're working in. First principle, I think, is that we let God's character lead transformation. God's character leading transformation. We have this naive notion that God is first concerned with our moral behaviors. And James points out that it is the Father of lights giving good things that drives out all darkness. That's a character statement based on a character quality of God. God's character quality is metaphor as light. In other words, he sees all, knows all. There is a certain sense here in which it's not about moral obedience so much as it is character transformation. And you need to lean into God's character, that character component that says, I bring life out of death. God is living, and therefore he makes you live. He's not just fixing your money problems because you're a poor money manager. He's not just fixing your marriage problems because you don't know how to do marriage right. He's transforming you through his character to be more like him. And hey, Folks, you got bad relationships in your life, or you don't know where your life is going, I want to tell you something. You need to be better men and better women anyway, regardless of how bad things are or the consequences of that effort. You realize you need to be better men and women, more godly men and women, regardless of what anybody else thinks or does in your life. You have to decide, crown of life, that's what I want. You don't know if your spouse is going to go with you. You don't know what that's going to do at your work. You don't know that what that might do at your schooling. So you let God's character lead transformation. Second thing I can see, you got to work on your junk. Don't just complain about it, but work on it. You got to work on it instead of complaining about it. It's easy for us to say, I just got all these problems. Kevin, I got all these problems. I've often told people I'm a much better coach than I am a counselor. A counselor lets you tell them all the problems. Complain, here we go. And hey, you need some time and some space for that. I'm not demeaning that. But for me, usually, the question eventually emerges, well, what are we going to do about it? Number one, God is not tempting you. It's not God's problem. It's God's solution. So it's your problem and it's God's solution. That means your expectation for resolving your problem is going to be very different when God gets involved. You're like, I struggle with alcohol, I struggle with pornography, I struggle with whatever. So you know what I need to do? I need to stop doing those things. Were it so easy? But have you thought for a second where the desires themselves come from? Let me just frame up the purity of heart from which we have fallen through sin. Apparently in the Garden of Eden, where we would all have been naked, walking about naked and perfect, we apparently would have had perfect control over our sexual desire. So that would mean your spouse, of all the naked people walking across your path in life, was the only sexually attractive person for you. Okay, a standard of self-control. That's a pretty big one, right? And yet it seems to be the model, the picture of the perfection. So you say, I need not to look at pornography anymore. Yeah, you're right. You start there. But you know the corruption goes deeper than that, right? It's the desire that drives it that God also will begin to work on. So you work on the junk that you have, but instead of just complaining about it, that means that decision has to have a next step. You see, we're working. God is working on us toward the root of sin to drive away all shadow, not just its expression, not just attitude and action, but also appetite for it. Number three, principle. You need to compound your understanding. You know, in the good old days, everybody journaled. It's just what you did. You had a journal. You go through your day. You write down what happened that evening or the next morning, and you journaled. And it was a way, a good discipline in most cultured places to compound your understanding. And I want to encourage you to do something like it. My 40 days prayer focus is a way of compounding my understanding. I have a written record of what I've prayed for and what I think God has answered and the extent to which he's answered it, and then the next 40 starts, and I pray again asking God for wisdom so that I can see what he has already done and what he's taught me through that and where he's led me through that, and then I set up again and I write it down, right? And now, through the gift of writing, now I have a record of both what I've asked and what I've seen God do. And it's changed the way I pray and the way I think because I'm compounding my understanding. I have in the course of ministry life, some 4,000 documents that are biblical study or biblical based somewhere. I mean, it's my job, so, you know, I produce a lot of material. But it's compounded understanding. You ought to be experts at your faith. You ought to know the source of truth, and you ought to compound that daily as a first order primary pursuit, not a secondary marginal thing. In order to be mature, you have to compound your understanding. Children do this. Adults in our jobs, we do this. People that fail to compound their understanding, well, they don't go very far in life. They're your general labor because they've never compounded their understanding. It's not only just a spiritual hack, it's also a life hack. And these principles, it's about being formed by the gifts of God. And so as God moves in your life, you need a way to record, learn, and grow from that, to reduce temptation. You see, the first great way to deal with temptation is to figure out how to build some barriers to the initial mindless response and action toward it. So listen, if you struggle with alcohol or if your spouse struggles with alcohol, I want to give you one really big life hack that you can do. Get all the alcohol out of your house and like when you get home. Not later when you're foolish, but right now while you're wise. You go home, you throw it out. If somebody has a problem with alcohol in your house, throw it out. Can you get it otherwise? Sure you can. But if somebody in your house has a problem with it, help a brother or a sister out and get rid of it. You compound your understanding. It is not the end-all, be-all, but it is a great first process. Number four, be part of the bigger work. Notice what he goes on to say. He says, every good gift, every perfect gift is from above, coming down from the unchangeable God. He's going to drive shadow away. But verse 18, of his own will, he brought us forth by the word of truth, that we should be a kind of first fruits of his creatures. Now, again, to a direction that seems almost completely out of context. First fruits language exists in a lot of places in the Bible. But I think here what he refers to is being a part of a bigger work. So he's talking about the pursuits of life, the pursuit that a disciple takes in life. And so he opens this up and he says, listen, when you decide to pursue the crown of life, there's that metaphor. He says, and then you become kind of a first fruits of his creatures, meaning you are on the front edge of what God is doing in his creation and to his creation. You've been equipped and made mature, and you have to be steadfast, and you have to stay in the game because you have a role to play in how God is forming and accomplishing his work in this world. You've got to get a bigger mind about why you follow Jesus. You don't follow Jesus so you can go to church sometimes. You follow Jesus because God has called you to reach the planet. That's a big place. There's a lot of folks in it. And he's called you in your little space. If God has given you children, then he's called you to reach them with the gospel. You realize every generation has to hear the word. Not just a general people, but all the people of that generation, that next generation. You have coworkers, you have classmates, all of them. You're part of this bigger work. You have to reach them. They need the light of the good and perfect gift of God in their lives as well. And you notice he's talking to people who are in the dispersion, as he says in verse 1. He says, you to the 12 tribes in the dispersion, yeah, you're out of sync, but you know what? God eventually brings everything in sync with his will. And you're a first fruits of that. Last principle. Endure to the breakthrough. Endure to the breakthrough. Some of us, so we hiked the Grand Canyon. But I don't know if you've been to the Grand Canyon. Very few people, quote, hike the Grand Canyon. It's a long ways. Now, I know there are people who are masochists, and they do that kind of thing. Maybe hike all the way to the bottom, camp in the valley on the Colorado River, and then hike all the way up. But that's a long way. The breakthrough moment is probably when you get to the bottom and you make your camp for the night. That's probably a breakthrough moment. And you have to endure to get there. We went on Grand Canyon hikes. We hiked the Grand Canyon. And we made it about a mile or about a mile. That's how far we made it. There was a checkpoint. And it was a viewing point where you could walk out on and look, loom into the down into it and across it. And we made it that far. And then because Dad was a baby, we turned around and headed back. That's as far as we made it. I didn't really endure to a breakthrough. I endured to a breakdown, and then we turned around and went the other way, right? Some of us, that's as far as we go. We endure to a breakdown, and then we turn and go the other way. And you can't endure to a breakdown and reach maturity. It may take immense pressure in your soul to form you. So you say to yourself, you know, like, this just doesn't seem right because I'm trying to do all the right things, but it's still so difficult for me. Notice what he lays out here. He doesn't talk about your strength. He doesn't talk about strength to do the things of God. He doesn't talk about strength to change yourself. He talks solely about endurance. Something incredibly important about that. You know what it is? If you're still walking, you're still on the path to that breakthrough, and there will be a moment of relief. And when that moment of relief comes, you'll say, hallelujah, thank you, Jesus, that you've done the work. You didn't have to be strong enough. You have to know that God knows your limitation. You're like, I just can't do it, Lord. But God knows. God knows where you're at, and God knows how far you can take it. My wife knows my limitations. They're not the same as my kids' limitations. My kids are like, oh, come on, Dad. They were a little older. We can go further. My knees hurt. I just can't make it any further. We did get to see a snake crossing the path on the way up. We wouldn't have got to do that if we went further. I mean, there's some benefits to being a weakling. Need to endure to the breakthrough, and you have to trust the wisdom of God. So if you're in that broken moment, here's how this ties back to what he told us in 1:5-8. You ask God for wisdom. Like, how far, Lord, do I need to go? Rarely have I felt God has told me how far is far enough and where the breakthrough actually shows up. It just shows up. But I think what we often find is God will take you to the last step you think you can make and at least a half step further. That's where change occurs and transforms and the heart shifts and you have a new soul and a new heart, as it were. So endure to the breakthrough. So, here's the question. Do you really want the gift of God? Do you really want the gift of God? Because the gift of God is a hard, pressurized thing. It's bigger, bolder, stronger, requires more endurance, more steadfastness than you have imagined. Do you really want the gift of God? You have to decide that you want that. You have to decide that the crown of life is the blessing that you seek out of this life. And you realize endurance actualizes that gift. It's what gets it cooked. Endurance, not your strength, not your knowledge, not your talent, not even understanding the wisdom of God, but His durable work in your life and your willingness to say yes all along the way. So do you really want the gift of God? That's our question this morning. And here's the other question. Who else needs this? You see, we think as ministers of the gospel, you and I together as ministers of the gospel, we get a word on Sunday. We get a word from the Spirit of God through His word to us. And there are people then that are around us who need this ministry, people who are living and dying, rising and falling, and they need to know that endurance is what God requires. So who else needs this? Who else needs the wisdom of God's direction in their life? You know, you can ask that for God's work in other people's life. Put it on your 40 days of prayer and ask God, look, I'm going to start, what's today? January 12th, tomorrow, I'm going to pray for this person for 40 days that God will help them to know Christ or will help them to turn their life around. And I'm going to watch for 40 days and I'm going to take the opportunities that God gives and I'm going to see God's wisdom produce results in their life. Who else needs this? I'm going to ask you to stand.